Thank you for listening to this audio recording from LimoPlanet 2020 Free the Future. The following talk was presented at LimoPlanet, the Free Software Foundation's annual conference on current issues in ethics, social justice, and technology. For more information on LimoPlanet, visit limoplanet.org/conference. LimoPlanet is a live conference with speakers who often use visual slides in their presentations. We have only selected talks for this audio feed that do not overly rely on visuals, but if you would like to see a speaker's slides, they are available at media.limoplanet.org. LimoPlanet speakers do not represent the Free Software Foundation. As part of our mission to show how important free software is to everyone, we have speakers talking about their use of free software in different kinds of political and commercial work. The FSF supports their freedom, but does not take positions on any political issues other than those necessary to uphold the principles of free software. Like all the FSF's work on behalf of the freedoms of all computer users, LimoPlanet is made possible by thousands of individuals who, like you, donate what they can. To keep this work going, please consider becoming an associate member via my.fsf.org/join or making a donation at my.fsf.org/donate. You can stay informed by subscribing to our newsletter, The Free Software Supporter, at fsf.org/fss.
Okay. Hello, my name is Bob, and I'm the room monitor for this. The talk is, it's my great pleasure to introduce Bradley Kuhn. The talk will be on preventing the IoT dystopia with copyleft.
And Brad. Thank you for the introduction. And I have a few remarks I want to make at the beginning here. Obviously, we're all aware of what's going on internationally right now with travel bans and so forth and things like that. I, as many people know, I used to work for the FSF years ago, and I'm just so impressed by the FSF staff. One of the things you have to do when you're an activist for software freedom, because it's a complicated and difficult cause, you've got to be willing to take on things that are hard to do and you might not succeed at. The idea of switching a conference that was designed to be an in-person conference to a fully online conference in just 5 days, that is quite an undertaking. And I am so impressed with the FSF staff and their willingness to do this. I really ask everybody to send their thanks to the FSF staff for trying to do this, because it's very, very impressive, and we may have technical difficulties. I think there probably have been some already, but hopefully this will all work, and I just think it's great that they made the effort to do this, and I want to thank the FSF staff specifically. So I'm going to switch to my slides, mainly because the one thing I wasn't able to solve technically was making it easy on my end to switch between the slides and my video. So I'm just going to speak and leave the slides on, and I'll switch back to my video feed of myself for Q&A. So this is a talk that I should also say that I often give this talk on behalf of Software Freedom Conservancy. That's why the slides are branded that way. I'm not speaking on behalf of Conservancy today. And so I just want to let folks know that, even though the slides are branded that way. The talk that I had wanted to give was unfortunately a talk that was really designed for an interactive in-person face-to-face audience. So I did switch to this talk. I'm using a talk that I've given before on behalf of Conservancy. But if you weren't at LCA 2019, I think is where I gave it, which was in Australia. So the Australians who have joined the feed might have seen this before, but I think it should be new to everybody else. But the basic idea that I want to get across in this talk is to help point out and help you understand, and those of you that are free software activists understand and be able to communicate, that the dangers and problems that we have with the Internet of Things that have been growing steadily for the past few years, they are in many ways GPL enforcement problems. They are problems that we can solve rather directly simply by enforcing copyleft licenses, particularly for the Linux project. So I've seen this joke often in other talks about why IoT is such a problem. And the joke is that the S in IoT stands for security. There is, of course, no S in IoT. And that's apt and true, that there really is not any thought given to the security and privacy issues with regard to IoT devices that are being deployed all over the industrialized world at this time. It is actually difficult in some product markets now to buy a device that is not the IoT version. For example, it's getting much more difficult to buy a refrigerator for your home that does not have a wireless chip in it and connect to your wireless network. Televisions are an even worse example. It's impossible to set up most televisions now without putting them on the internet, at least for the initial setup. So we've gotten to a moment where this lack of security in IoT is impacting everybody. This is a story from a couple of years ago now, and there have been even worse stories at this point. This last December, a young girl was in a room and was told by the security camera in the room that Santa Claus was watching her through the security camera. I have no idea how much lifelong problems that poor kid is going to have, that this camera started talking to her when she was 6 years old, telling her it was Santa Claus. These problems are becoming more and more common, that these devices that are insecure, installed in people's homes, are being taken over by malicious hackers. They're being watched by the companies that control the devices. It's become very common that Amazon will encourage you to share your video from Ring devices with Amazon so that they can share it with the police at their decision, which is a really ironic, well, it's obvious why Amazon's doing that, right? Because the biggest thing that video cameras on doorbells catch are people stealing delivered packages. So Amazon is often the shipper of those packages. So of course they want to decide for you whether or not the video gets shared with the police, because they don't want to ship a replacement package if it gets stolen. But that completely cuts across and takes away people's privacy, people's rights not to be surveilled, and all sorts of other rights that we have in our societies are being eradicated and eroded by IoT devices, ironically running Linux. So what do we do about this problem? We're really good as free software hackers, you know, geeks who write good software, to identify problems. And I think generally speaking, we have a tendency to talk a lot about what things are wrong. I hear lots of people talking about how concerned about privacy they are, how concerned about all these sorts of things they are, and that they'll happily tell other people about them. They'll happily not install these kind of devices. I don't have these devices installed in my home. This is the first time a video camera has been on in my home for some time. But I think when we look at people in our lives, they are using these devices and we're not giving them the tools to solve them. One of the interesting things about the kernel name Linux is that it was for many years a really good counterexample to how the technical community was able to create something that solved a big problem. I realize this is Libre Planet and there's a lot of folks who like to remind everyone to call it GNU/Linux and so forth. But the wonderful thing about Linux was that it was quickly deployed and was readily available to people as a solution that really, really worked. I bought my first laptop in 1992. This is not the exact one that I bought, but it's the most similar picture on the internet that I could find to what my laptop in 1992 looked like. And when I installed Linux on it, for the first time, I downloaded the SLS distribution and I had pretty much everything I needed to run that device. It was really a fully free software device. It did have a proprietary BIOS, admittedly, but it was a moment in history when the computer technology that you could buy, generally speaking, was fully capable of running free software. I'm fully capable of giving the user the ability to recompile and install and test patches. And that's how I became a free software activist and hacker, was that I got the first chance at software freedom because of Linux and the software freedoms that it gave me specifically.
Brad, this is the room monitor. Could you check your slides? It seems that slides are not advancing.
Okay, they're advancing for me. I think the only thing I can do at this point is reload. I loathe to do this, but I think I'm gonna have to reload the Jitsi. Do you think that's the best idea?
I do not know. It's kind of beyond my pay grade.
Okay. Well, let me give it a try and see. I'll do it. The worst that can go wrong is I won't get as much time to talk. Hopefully that brought me back. Did it?
And hello, everybody. We're just having a little technical difficulty hello? Here, and we'll
did that bring me back?
Back online again in just a very quick moment.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me again? Hello? Hello? I can hear you fine. Can you hear me? Okay. Well, I did just reload. Do you want me to do it again?
However, it so happens that I cannot.
So should I reload again or continue?
Bradley, please continue.
All right, are you able to hear me? Okay, I'm going to share the slides again.
Yes,
I'm going to also let everyone know as I do that. Take a look at the URL bar when it comes up. That URL bar has these are on the internet. So if my slides stop again, I'm just going to encourage everybody to go ahead and load from that URL, because that's probably the best way to follow along. So I'm going to continue. So what was most interesting to me about the rise of Linux specifically, and I am talking about the kernel project Linux, was that it was an entirely hobbyist project at the time. And what's happened in the Linux community specifically is that it's changed its own history. It's sort of rewritten its history. Linux, when folks started developing it as a kernel, was not something that manufacturers were interested in. In fact, Linux developers had to reverse engineer lots of hardware. They had to figure out how it worked. They had to make things work on those particular manufacturers. It's very rare that anyone's laptop came with Linux. I suspect everybody who's listening, if you have a laptop, it didn't have Linux running on it pre-installed. And it's actually still really hard to get Linux on a laptop when you try to buy one. It's relatively rare. And when I compare it to what it was like in 1992, there were one or two vendors in 1992 that would do it for you. And there's about that many vendors now that will do it for you. None of the major ones have done it. Now, the interesting thing that's changed in the last 30 some years since I first installed the kernel Linux on my machines is that Linux is commonly pre-installed on all these IoT devices. So most of these devices, these cameras and everything else that you would buy at regular big box stores, turn out to have Linux on them already. And one of the reasons why I keep saying Linux in this talk is they're not running GNU. In fact, they're running Linux with Android, or they're running Linux with just a small BusyBox and a few other utilities. But we're not in a scenario where you're regularly finding free software pre-installed anywhere but these kinds of devices. And there has been a pretty strong community, particularly in the Android phone market, where people install alternative firmwares from time to time. The fact of the matter is it's relatively rarely done. If you take a look at the number of these types of devices out there in the world, you'll find that most of them are still running the stock firmware. And even in the cases where people have tried to reinstall firmwares, it's usually a very small number of the devices available in a particular space, be it phones or doorbell cameras or TVs and so forth, where the devices actually support installation of an alternative firmware. Now, the interesting thing is that the FSF did a very good job creating a license that Linux ended up using. That license includes an assertion to assure that people can install modified versions. In particular, there are these, which I think are the most important 11 words in GPLv2, where it says the scripts used to control compilation and installation of the executable. For today's world, these are the most important rights in GPL version 2 that are expressed, because it is the most common spot where GPLv2 is violated, specifically with regard to the kernel named Linux. The first IoT device, in fact, was this wireless router. This was the first time in the early 2000s when Linux showed up on a very small device as an operating system. And GPL enforcement is what created the OpenWRT project. I apologize for the dead link there. That's just a link to the main OpenWRT website where they talk about in the history page how OpenWRT came into existence. OpenWRT came into existence because we enforced the GPL on the Linksys router, which was then bought by Cisco, and assured that a source code release was released and that it had the scripts used to control compilation and installation of the executable. Now, the question is whether OpenWRT is particularly unique. Are wireless routers particularly unique? We have to think about what we do with all these other devices. In general, most IoT devices have never had a serious alternative firmware project. And when I began with my employer, the Software Freedom Conservancy, doing BusyBox GPL enforcement, we were somewhat ahead of our time. We started enforcing the GPL for BusyBox specifically because these things that were the burgeoning IoT market at the time were the devices that we wanted to see the source code for. We wanted the ability to see, modify, improve, and reinstall the source code on these devices. One of the TVs that when we followed those, that there was a large group of BusyBox lawsuits that Software Freedom Conservancy and Eric Anderson were the plaintiffs for. That one of those was a Samsung TV, and we got a release that was truly rebuildable and truly easily rebuildable by people who had the devices. And it briefly, although this project is mostly defunct, started an alternative firmware project called Samigo, which works to this day on a very narrow set of Samsung TVs, specifically the group of models that were made available during the time that the BusyBox lawsuits were ongoing. So from my point of view, the whole point of GPL enforcement is to get the scripts used to control compilation, installation of the executable. The reason that's now the basic goal of GPL enforcement is because we've gotten to the point where the upstream projects are good enough that the vendors don't really need to modify the actual features of the software all that much to make it work great on their devices. There's lots of upstream work, for example, in the Linux project being funded to make it work well on ARM. And ARM is the main processor that appears in these devices. So all of it works, they can get it working. But what's most interesting is how they get it compiled and installed for their little IoT device. So at this point, these are the most common GPL violations we see, and it is the most important part of the GPL with regard to IoT devices. I have huge concerns about what's happened in the Linux upstream community. And I talked a minute ago about the rewriting of history that's occurred in that community. And I'll put a little finer point on that. Historically, Linux was an underdog project. It was hard to get a kernel project going. It's part of the reasons why Herb didn't succeed. It was because of the difficulty of making a kernel project want. And a lot of people, and a lot of people circled around Linux because it was interesting and it was trying to do things in a more traditional way that looked like it might work on the x86 series of processors. And no one in the corporate world cared that much about it. But as time went on, industry picked up Linux and it became popular, it became a buzzword, and so forth. And that led to these corporate users to be interested. Most people who were upstream developers of Linux who were hobbyists in the late 90s, early 2000s began to be employed working for many of these companies working on Linux. And the history kind of got rewritten as if companies were what made Linux successful. I once had an argument with a Linux developer specifically about he's a key member of the Linux leadership about the issue of scripts used to control compilation installation. And his answer was, well, I like the GPL, but all I want are the C files because I don't really care, he said, if it builds or installs, because he wasn't building and installing on the devices we were enforcing about. He was building and installing on big hardware at his big company that he worked for. And it didn't matter to him if they didn't modify the C files. And I think that's a very narrow view. Matthew Garrett, in a very contentious email thread on the, I think it was on the Linux Summit Discuss mailing list of all places, there was a very contentious thread about GPL enforcement. And Matthew Garrett made this really excellent post, and this is a quote from it, where he talks about the issue of what is Linux upstream focusing for? Is it trying to get exactly what big companies want, this little tiny improvements that will make very small group of very wealthy users happy? Or is it trying to get the next 19-year-old developer excited about free software so that they will become an upstream Linux developer later on? And if your goal is to create more people who want to work on upstream free software projects, you darn well better, in both Matthew's view and mine, focus on making sure that those potential developers, when they get an IoT device, can actually hack that IoT device, can actually recompile Linux and all the other GPL software that might be on it and reinstall the firmware so that they can try out the changes that they make. I have always felt the hobbyist firmware modifier, the individual person, matters most about copyleft. I feel like we're at a moment where we're not going to have new upstream developers coming to free software projects. I think it's becoming more and more likely that upstream developers for the core infrastructure projects like Linux are becoming rarer and rarer because it's harder to get involved. You need access to hardware that you don't have to be able to do it. And it's so weird that we can still install Linux-based systems on our laptops without too much trouble. There's a lot of negative proprietary firmwares floating around in the main, in the peripheral devices and in the BIOSes, which there are projects working to try and solve. And it's getting harder and harder. I'm actually doing this presentation on a laptop, my wife's laptop, which is not 100% free software because my X200 is too slow to process video because it's a fully free software laptop, but it's very old, precisely because it's hard to get newer laptops. But at the very least, I don't know of any laptop on the market today that you can not install a generally free operating system modulo a few proprietary device drivers. But when we compare that to where we are at IoT, we've totally lost the battle. You can't go to a big box store and buy a video camera and expect to install an alternative firmware. You can't go to a mobile phone store and expect to install an alternative firmware on your mobile phone. And I think that there have been errors on both sides with regard to the reaction to Linux. I suspect some of you are annoyed that I keep talking about Linux and not GNU who are listening. But I think on both sides, we haven't looked at how important Linux is to the history of free software. There is absolutely no doubt in my mind that Linux is the most important copylefted program in the history of the world ever created. And the reason that it's so important and the reason it was successful was because users could install it on their own devices as soon as they got it and the devices actually worked. And I don't think that will continue if folks can't install their own software. For those who don't like Linux as a project, and believe me, there are reasons not to like Linux as a project. There's a lot of problems in Linux as a community with regard to diversity, with regard to lots of things. But I think it's important still and worth working through those problems precisely because Linux is already there. And if we can do the GPL enforcement to improve the situation, that's your users. At this point, there are thousands of people who work on the kernel name Linux upstream, but downstream, there's at least 2 billion users, at least, because that's just what Google was reporting in 2017 as the number of Android devices deployed. So I suspect it's even much more than 2 billion. There's every single doorbell camera out there that's most likely running Linux. There's every single wireless router. There's every single TV at this point. There's every single refrigerator at this point that are also Linux-based devices. So I our friends and colleagues. And I also think that there's a silent plurality and a loud minority who agree about software freedom and Linux. And those people are huge allies that we need to build alliances with. And we can't have arguments with them about like what word we call things and so forth. If we're going to actually get to software freedom.
Technical difficulties happening.
We're fortunate that all of the upstream including big for-profit companies that really don't want to see software freedom in the world, because of the way Linux worked out and its success, they are licensing under a license that works. I too wish that Linux were licensed under GPLv3 rather than GPLv2. I am saddened that the advocacy for GPLv3 was frankly botched such that GPLv2 became the de facto license in the Linux community, and there is so much hatred over GPLv3 because of the way that the process was botched. But GPLv2 is a really good license. We just need to take advantage of the opportunity that's there of all this code under GPLv2 only being deployed in almost every device on the planet that's being produced today that's smarter than a toaster. And I'm sure soon toasters will actually run Linux, which was the joke that we told in 1993. So it's very interesting to me that IoT device liberation doesn't actually require a revolution. Software freedom as a cause is really a revolution in a lot of ways because it required writing software from scratch. It required convincing people to install software. But with regard to these IoT devices, the words are already in the GPL that we need that assure the right to reinstall the scripts used for compilation and modification of the executable and installation of the executable. And it assures that we can get the software freedom we need to reinstall firmwares. We just basically need to take back this right, these freedoms. And basically everyone who is buying devices today can actually make a difference on this. The first thing that you can do that's so easy is anytime you buy a device, if there's an offer for source, or if you know that it's running Linux for whatever reason, such as using just Nmap to talk to its TCP/IP stack, and Nmap will tell you with the right options whether it's Linux's TCP/IP stack. If there's Linux in there, request the sources on those devices. And don't just get the CD in the mail, because believe it or not, they mostly still do mail CDs. But actually try to build and install that software in your device. Yes, you may end up breaking your device. You may have paid $200 for a little IoT device that does something cool and you end up breaking it. And that can, I understand, be financially painful. But ask friends to help. You can write to compliance at SF Conservancy, where I work, to ask for help. And if it doesn't build and install, you can definitely write that address and report it as a violation for something we can do. The other thing that's a bit tougher to do that I would love to see people do is pick a device of this nature, one of these IoT devices that you like, that matters to you, that does behaviors that you're interested in, and step up to be a leader in maintaining alternative firmware. OpenWRT didn't happen by accident. OpenWRT happened because a group of developers picked up that Linksys source release that was, it built but and installed, but it was kind of in pieces in a lot of ways. It was very similar to what happened with BSD when BSD was finally liberated, where what was actually released under the BSD license was not a full operating system, and developers got together and wrote, made FreeBSD a real project. That's what happened with the Linksys release. OpenWRT just wasn't born a real project. Developers got together with that release, modified the software, and got it installed on those devices. I know that this problem probably seems insurmountable. There are so many devices, and the life cycle of them is very short. But one of the interesting things that we're seeing with this unfortunate scenario with regard to a global pandemic is that weird things can happen that we didn't expect that will slow all the markets down. I would expect that right now people aren't going to be buying lots of new IoT devices in the next next 8 months or so. And what does that mean? Well, it means that the life cycle of the IoT device, which is normally 18 months on the outset, will get a little longer. It means there'll be more of them around. And it means you'll have more time to get an alternative firmware working and encourage people to install it. The important thing to remember is that we already have these rights guaranteed. It's already in there in the license. We just have to demand our rights. It's kind of like living in a free society where you have a constitution where the rights are slowly being eroded. It's not that they've disappeared. It's that the system is starting to kind of chip away at them, but it means you can organize and do something useful because you have the legal document sitting there that guarantees your rights. And that's exactly what GPL does. I think the reason we can succeed in trying to do this is because of the privacy and security issues. We are in a situation where the mainstream media, like I said, just last December, is running stories about scared children being told that Santa Claus is living in their camera by some malicious hacker. In those situations, we have a clear answer. We are going to make it. It's not that we all know that free software is not perfect with regard to privacy and security. It doesn't guarantee it, but it is a necessary first step. And it's very easy to say that we cannot, and very correct, by the way, to say we cannot assure that people's privacy and security is possible with non-free software. It is impossible to have privacy and security with non-free software. We don't get it for free. We're going to have to work at it when we switch to free software, but we get the first step in the right direction. We have to convince users to take back control of the operating systems they run. And the way that we convince them is we give them alternative that's better. That's always what free software has done best. We've given people better software that was free. And it's not that free software is better by default. It's better because the people who work on it are more passionate, care more, work harder, and care about users more than those who work on proprietary software. We can restore the balance of power by making it easy for people to use this software. So as I mentioned, this talk is on my own behalf, but I'm using slides and I'm just kind of repeating parts of the talk that I've given in the past for Conservancy. Here's information about where I work. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to switch back to my regular camera, and hopefully I'm going to be able to hear the questions. So we'll see how all that goes. So I'm switching back to my camera now. And if anybody has questions or comments that they want to share, please go ahead. I think there's a moderator in the room who's going to take care of, translating them from IRC or... Okay, I hear nothing, so that's not good.
Yes, this is the room monitor, and I'll be asking.
Right, I'm making sure my volume is set.
IRC,
I hope I just haven't been talking to nobody for all this time. For you?
Oh, that is not good, but you should be hearing something in a moment.
Hello? I'm going to reload because I can't hear. I think somebody might be talking and I can't hear them. I'm going to reload.
There is a long delay lag between me talking and you.
I can hear you.
Okay, so I have a question from the channel, and I know there's a very long delay, so please have a little bit of patience, and I'll read this question from GJAY, which I know the name, but that's the handle here. Question, is there progress on virtualization and emulation so that IoT makers can provide virtualized interfaces, so that people can build and install on virtual machines?
Yeah, it's a really important issue, and it's a good question. I think that generally speaking, I'm not aware of any progress in that regard, and I think generally speaking, IoT manufacturers don't want you to be able to do that. I suspect those problems are solved inside some of these companies that produce these devices. I suspect that they're able to build and run emulators and all that sort of thing. The GPL does not require them to give us their emulators, so we're not likely to get that from them, and the GPL is not going to cause that to happen. Even GPL v3 or Faro GPL v3, for that matter, wouldn't even get us that necessarily. So we can't rely on license enforcement or licensing for that. I think what needs to happen is individual developers have to get excited about this issue and build those tools. I don't know much about those. And I think when you look back at the early history of, say, OpenWRT, that was done by edit, compile, test, and possibly bricking the device, right? And we may have to start there with IoT. It's not easy work, but it's also not insurmountable. Okay, I think nobody's talking.
And another question from REMN. Question, are there certain types of IoT devices that you consider the most important?
I think it's complicated, right? A lot of people will point to televisions because notwithstanding the change of how people consume media, the television is, at least in the United States, is still the kind of center of the home, as it has been since the 1950s. And as such, people say, well, pretty much anybody who's in the middle class or higher has a television in their house, and therefore it's the most important device. one of the reasons I haven't felt it's the most important device to try to get a free firmware running on is we run into the nasty DRM problem when we do, right? So my fear about getting free firmwares running on televisions is, okay, great, we got a free firmware for televisions like the Samigo project had for a few of the models. And the first thing people will want to do, sadly enough, is run the proprietary Netflix client on that free firmware and be able to watch DRM'd media because there are so many people using DRM'd media now. So I'm less inclined to focus on that, even though it is probably the most popular IoT device and is arguably the highest priority. I think that the highest priority device for anyone who understands the issues that I've just been talking about is the device that you are most interested in. And the reason why I say that is if you're interested in the device, it means you're going to have an incentive for yourself as a hobbyist to try to get it working, try to get its sources to build, try to get an alternative firmware project started about it, and so forth. So I really think that that's what happened with OpenWRT and why it was successful, because people really wanted a free firmware for wireless routers they could do interesting things with. So we really need people who care about their devices. I think the only addendum I would make to that is a device that is most likely going to invade your privacy is probably the highest priority. So when I'm thinking about what kind of IoT, and I'm looking into getting involved in projects like this to create alternative firmwares, I'm really interested in issues about video cameras, surveillance cameras, doorbell cameras, because those are the ones most likely to invade people's privacy. And I'd much rather, if they get deployed, see them deployed in a way that the user who installs it at least controls it. It doesn't solve the problem of the person walking by the camera's privacy, but at least we decentralize the problem so that the state or Amazon or someone else isn't in ultimate control of all these cameras that are around. I'm ready for the next question. I know there's a delay.
Okay, very good. There's about a 10-second delay, literally, so that's why there's a little patience. Question from Floppus. What about TiVoization? Does the GPL v2 compliance require, for example, unlocking bootloaders?
So I am a radical. I'm more radical than many other leaders in free software about this. I firmly believe the scripts used to control installation means that you have to be able to reinstall something even when it's under GPL v2. Now, it will be a court fight at some point to fight whether GPL v2 actually permits or prohibits cryptographic lockdown of devices. I'm sure that someday we're going to have that battle. But given that Linux is under GPL v2, the worst case scenario is we have that battle and we lose it, and it really proves that we desperately need a kernel under GPL v3. I'd rather get that answer sooner rather than later myself. It will take a long time because it's an answer only courts will give us. But I think we should proceed with what I've always said, which is GPL v3's installation information details were just a clarification on what was already there in v2. And I think those who have said that cryptographic lockdown does not relate to GPL v2, I think that's wrong. The intent was clear. No one, especially the FSF, would have published a license designed to assure that people could recompile, rebuild, modify, and reinstall their software and not intend it for the user to get a device they couldn't reinstall the software. And I want to also add, because the word TiVoization was used in the question, that's a phrase that I don't use. And the reason I don't use it is because the way TiVo complied with GPL v2 was perfectly fine for us. And I'm baffled why activists of GPL v3 use that term. What TiVo did, and I know this because I worked at the FSF at the time and did personally the GPL enforcement against TiVo, they decided that what they were going to do was make it the case when you buy a TiVo, if you choose to recompile the operating system for the TiVo and reinstall it with your modifications or not, then the proprietary TiVo application ceases to work. In essence, what happens with a TiVo when you reinstall the operating system from your own build is you get a little nice box with some interesting hardware to make your own DVR with. You can take those boxes and people have and repurpose them to just install Kodi on and use that as a completely free software box. I think that outcome was absolutely fine. I have no problem with that. I don't care when I reinstall that firmware, my own firmware that I built, the whole user space proprietary application stack that the vendor gave me, I don't want that anyway because I hate proprietary software and I think it takes my freedom away. So I'm happy to start from base principles, get a free software operating system running, and then go searching around for what other free software exists in the application space to do my job or write it myself if I have to. Obviously, I'd rather reuse what's out there. So I think that we're in a good spot with regard to this because we don't want the proprietary IoT applications they're giving us. They've given us a free base operating system to start with. That allows us to repurpose the hardware, throw away the proprietary stuff, let them say, hey, part of our lockdown strategy is you reinstall Linux and you get like a little bash shell or a BusyBox shell on the device when it was supposed to be doing your thermostat or whatever else it was supposed to be doing. Okay, we'll start from scratch and write our own thermostat software, write our own video camera software, whatever we need to do. That's what free software folks have always done. And I'm going to wait the 10-second delay for the next question.
And that was an excellent talk, but we have reached the end of the allotted time.
Understood.
At this time. So I think with that, we should close the talk. Very excellent talk, Bradley. Thank you very much.
Thank you for all those who soldiered through doing an online conference to come see this talk. I much appreciate your attendance. Thank you.